This is the University of Georgia Griffin News, brought to you over WKU AM 1450, 102.3 FM, The Rock 88.9 FM, and stream live on WKUradio.com. This program is to update our listeners on the many and exciting things at the University of Georgia Griffin with Dr. Lou Honeycutt and his guests. The program is made possible by Frank and Carolyn Harris of Round Oak Resources Tree Farms and Murray and Company Realtors. And now today's program with Dr. Lou Honeycutt.
Well, good morning, Griffin, Spalding County and the surrounding area, and happy spring. We've got an incredible program to be starting the first day of spring with. We're glad y'all joined us here today. As always, we thank our sponsors for the show, and I never properly thank Tony, the producer of the show. He sits here and does all the hard stuff, and I just get to talk. So, Tony, good morning, and thank you so much for what you do.
I'm just an ancillary benefit.
There you go. We have a great show. I say this every week, but I mean it as sincerely this week as I do any other week. We have an incredibly great show today, and first time in 10 years that this person's been on the radio, so shame on all of us. We should have had you on here before, but it's a perfect person to have on the first day of spring because of the topics that we're going to talk about. But it is Dr. Bodhi Panisi, who's a professor in the UGA College of Agriculture and Environmental Sciences Horticulture Department and been on the UGA Griffin campus for some time. So what we do first, Bodhi, the first thing you have to do is tell us from birth until now how you got to this seat. Because one of the main things I like to do this is to quote unquote humanize the faculty to the listeners. Y'all are nice and just normal, and you're not some kind of strange researcher in a hole somewhere. So tell us, Bodhi, how did you from birth till now? How did you get to this chair?
Well, good morning, Griffin, and thank you, Tony, and thank you, Lou.
You bet.
I'm excited to be here, and as you said, it's a great beginning for a great spring season. Hopefully, we'll have a great year of growing plants.
Hopefully.
A little bit about myself. I am from Bulgaria. I grew up in Bulgaria. I went to school, had my master's in viticulture and gardening.
Oh, actually, I didn't know. I already learned something new about you.
And I came to U.S. in 92 on an internship. So I had an opportunity to work in a very large greenhouse operation in Apopka, Florida. They grew foliage plants. And you may remember years and years ago, because they're closed now, they got appropriated by a larger firm. It was angel plants, Herman Engelmann greenhouses. Huh. So you'd see these baskets in all the mass market stores, and they had a little angel.
Oh,
so
very cool.
They were called angel plants. But so anyway, I spent a year working, learned how to grow indoor plants, had a great hands-on experience. And from there on, I went to study, do a master's and then a PhD in the Environmental Horticulture Department at the University of Florida. So note of full disclosure, I'm a closet gator, so sorry about that.
Oh, I could have gone on. So I'm here with a Georgia Tech producer and a Florida gator. I don't know if I can handle this, but
that made my grandma and my mother-in-law, excuse me, very, very happy. That's for her.
Well, and then just as a reminder, even for your family back in Bulgaria, they can search podcasts or do the podcast of this show, or they can live stream it. They can do all kinds of things and listen to you on the radio.
Today. Great.
So it's pretty awesome.
I'll be sure to tell them.
Well, the reason I like to do it, and I'm going to ask you another question about that in a minute, is I love the international flair that the Griffin campus has. I mean, we have such an incredible array of students and faculty from all around the world. I think we're doing it now. We think there's like 23 countries represented on campus. We'll hope eventually I can get that number so I can quit saying I think. But we're going to start celebrating that because I think it's an incredible part of that we add to Griffin and the surrounding area. But my question to you first is, and this is kind of putting you on the spot, but I hope the answer is easy for you. I in my life had a true mentor person that really just set me on the right path, because I was going to ranch and be a cowboy and never do anything but stay on the ranch all my life. And I had a grandmother that said the words to me, immortal words to me, there's more to you than this. And it truly set me on a different course. During your life, whether you're a child or in college or wherever, did you have that one person that kind of, you were lucky enough to have that, and you may have had a group of them, but a mentor force that said, Bodhi, you're going to do this?
It started in Bulgaria when I was in high school, and I probably have something in common with many, many kids in the U.S. and probably around the world. But at the time, Cosmos with Carl Sagan was on the air, and this was remarkable for me. It was really, truly a transformative experience. I became much more interested in science, and I really wanted to be an astronomer, really an exobiologist.
Oh, we all did. I agree.
Yeah, cool, right? but things didn't really work out for the out of planet experience for me. So I looked into biology, and then from there, my career started in agriculture, and then I fell in love with growing plants and learning all about plants. And so that was kind of like on the outside.
Sure.
But then once I got into University of Florida, I had this remarkable person who was my major professor, Dr. Dennis McConnell. And he's retired, and he is in Florida, so I get to see him every time I see my family
there. Sure.
And so he really was instrumental, integral to my growth, personal and professional. So, yes, I thank him every day.
And see, that's great. And I love that story. And I like for everyone, not everyone has the kind of mentors that we're talking about. And I just, it's my hope that people find that one person that is that supporting light that says, wait a minute, there's more to you than this. And poof, now I'm in the University of Georgia. So it works, right? And I'm not in outer space. And I saw those shows too. And Carl Sagan's responsible for a lot of frustration in a lot of people because we couldn't go to outer space. But because I wanted to, too, as a small Panhandle of Texas kiddo. But so when did you, and you may have said this a minute ago, but when did you come to the University, to the Griffin campus?
I came in 2002. I spent a year and a half working as an extension specialist in the floriculture field in Tifton.
Okay.
That's how I first started in June of 2000. So okay. That was great. I really, really enjoyed learning about South Georgia and,
sure.
and the people and the country there. And as you can imagine, coming from Bulgaria and then even spending years in Florida, it was really nothing like Georgia. So
sure.
It's been a remarkable ride, and I'm truly enjoying it.
No, that's awesome. So that's a long tenure track with UGA, which is great. You still have your Bulgarian accent, which I love. I think that's incredible. I don't sense it. Maybe I'll hear a Georgia word every once in a while or a southern inflection. But
you reckon?
There you go. Perfect. Exactly. That's great. So we're very happy about that. Well, today is the first day of spring. What a great day to have you on here, because I want you to kind of explain in a broad sense what you do for the University of Georgia Griffin campus. We're going to narrow it back down into some really cool flowers and stuff in a minute, but kind of broad-based, what areas are you looking at?
Well, I'm the statewide extension landscape specialist. So I work with commercial landscape operations in the state. I support the county operations when it comes to landscape businesses and people interested in starting in the landscape business. So I work through the cooperative extension service and the faculty that are in each of the counties. And whenever there is a need for consultation or a program, I put some of those together. I work in the, with the Center for Urban Agriculture on many of their efforts in educating the industry, the green industry, and the proper application of chemicals, fertilizers, pesticides, biological control, proper selection of plants for our ornamental landscapes. Some of the things that I do on the research side are related to protecting our environmental resources. And also recently I've become really interested in working with pollinators.
Sure.
And figuring out what we can do to provide the floral resources and also to encourage habitat in our urban matrix, what we call urban matrix, which are the areas where we live and work. The other thing that I've been interested in the last couple of years, and I guess we'll spend a fair amount of time talking about it,
sure.
is a project that really came out of Cornell University with a colleague of mine, Bill Miller. He's a premier bulb expert in the country, if not the world, really.
Okay.
And he called me and Clint Waltz, who is a turf grass specialist also on the Griffin campus, and he was interested in collaborating with us on a large-scale project looking at spring flowering bulbs planted under turf. And so we started that last December. And so we're seeing the results on the campus.
Oh, absolutely.
And I encourage everyone to come and take a look at those.
Absolutely. It's beautiful.
It's really remarkable. So we're really excited about it.
Well, we'll go ahead and flesh that out a little bit, and then we'll talk about pollinators in a minute. But tell me the number of bulbs y'all planted on campus.
We planted 12,000 bulbs by hand. So that means that someone, and there are 12 of us, had to manually pick a single bulb and plant it in the right place.
That's incredible.
And
this was in December, wasn't it?
That was December. Okay. December. And then we had like a demo area where we planted with the bulb planter, and those were probably about 3,000 bulbs.
Okay.
And they went a lot faster because they didn't have to be handled individually, manually.
But how incredible, and kind of, you know, what are all the types of flowers are there? It's incredible color. I mean, you've seen it. I've seen pictures of that a lot. I walk by it every morning in one of the areas, and it's just so pretty. But I don't know all the names of the flowers. I know the tulips and the daffodils and all, but what else are in that? What else was in that mix?
The tulips, the daffodils, and the hyacinths are the most prominent.
Okay.
They're the largest blooms, and the tulips being the red ones, you tend to see those because they stand out next to the daffodils, which are usually anywhere between, you know, white, yellow. And then we also have a number of smaller bulbs that provide the blue color. So we have grape hyacinth, which is Muscari.
Okay.
We have glory of the snow, Chionodoxa. That's in the research part of the trial. Muscari is in the demo area and in the research part of the trials. So I mentioned the daffodils, hyacinths, which are very nice and very fragrant.
They're so pretty, yeah.
And then crocuses, too.
Okay.
So.
It's an incredible array. And in front of the Center for Urban Ag is, I guess,
a demonstration plot.
And then out in some of the turf grass plots, though, there are the ones that are on the research project, correct?
Correct.
And, I mean, it's just been an incredible our campus is beautiful to begin with, but when you can walk from main parking to anywhere on the quad – and walk past an incredible – I don't know how many are up right now, but it's just awfully colorful.
Well, there are thousands at least.
It's so pretty out there. So we would hope everybody else that's listening would come by, and it is perfectly fine to park and walk around campus and smell the roses, so to speak, or the tulips.
The bulbs.
The bulbs, anyway. So it's been a great, great project. On the research side of it – on the research side of it, so out in the plots – What's the purpose, or what's the hypothesis on the research project, or what are y'all doing that for?
We're looking at the possibility and the potential for double cropping or transitional lawns, anything that actually has multi-use from the same plot of land. So we all enjoy our lawns, right?
Sure.
We need to have them. They're great for the environment. They're great for us, you know, gets to spend outside with a dog, with the kids, you know, running around. So it's good to have those. We would like them to be a little bit more colorful. Maybe that's coming from me being the floriculture person. Clint Waltz may disagree with me. Green is good. Green is great color.
Sure.
I just like a little bit more color.
More color.
So we're looking at both warm season grass, such as Bermuda, and a cool season grass, such as the tall fescue.
Okay.
So there are two parts of the trial, and if you look around, it will be in two places on campus. People usually notice first the Bermuda plot because it's closest to the road.
Sure.
And the one you actually have to drive or walk, and you may not feel comfortable because it's like outside of the public spaces.
Sure.
And kind of distance away, that's the tall fescue plot. And so what we're looking at is, again, the performance of the individual species and then some cultivars. For example, we have two crocus cultivars and three daffodil cultivars.
Okay.
And they were selected for various reasons. Again, they do flower at different times, they have different heights, and they have different color. So a combination would really be ideal, but we also wanted to see the performance. So which one performs better? Maybe one does better than others. Maybe one is more prominent. Maybe it emerges in higher numbers. And then we also looked at, we're trying to see what would happen over time. So 2 years, 3 years,
sure.
We're hoping that a large number of these plants will perennialize. In other
right.
words, they will naturalize. They'll become part of what's in the ground. So a homeowner or a landscape company will not have to replant those again. So that's the double cropping and the multi-use from the same space.
Sure. Oh, and again, like I'm saying, there people need to come out and see them because they're incredible. And they seem to flower longer than others I've seen. Don't know if that's an added effect or you're trying to look at that, but even the tulips, typically tulips don't last very long. These are lasting a They seem to be lasting a long time. They must just love it.
It may be the water that we got.
Maybe. I mean, something's going on. But so the color is lasting quite a while, which I was a little nervous at first that it'd be this great show and then it's gone. But it's I mean, it's lasted several weeks now, and it just changes all the time.
Right. And that's the thing, is some bulbs emerge earlier than others, and so the crocuses are some of the first that emerge, but they're also done very quickly.
Okay.
And then the daffodils kind of have a long, you know, flowering, and they seem to be the one that are unfazed by practically anything. So if I were to recommend bulb, that would be the daffodils. They seem to be really, really tough and really great
really
performance. And we know they naturalize for us in Georgia.
Sure.
I mean, you could see them out.
You
know,
can tell where
around.
Old homesteads are to me. Just driving down the country, because you'll see nothing but a bunch of daffodils out
Absolutely.
There. So there was a homestead there at one time, probably.
Right.
So I always say.
Yeah.
And then the great thing about the ones you're using is they really are multicolored. I mean, there's yellows all the way down to whites. I'd never seen the white ones.
There are
great
some
numbers.
That are orange.
Right.
We didn't have orange with ours, or there's some that actually have subtle color within the individual blooms.
Sure.
So you have, like, the corolla is a little bit lighter colored or darker colored. So they are multi-petal ones, so you have a little bit more of a, like, a rose look, if
sure.
you will. Not that you're going to
sure.
have a rose-looking daffodil, but you know.
They're a fuller looking than a
exactly.
regular daffodil. No, they're so
and
pretty.
There's some that are, you know, they have multiple blooms coming on the same spike.
Okay.
One of the cultivars has two coming from each spike, so that's a little
okay.
bit interesting. That's the one that has a little bit more of a light color to it, very, very attractive, and it seems to have very good emergence. So I'm very, very happy about that one.
Well, and are these bulbs already commercially available to people?
Yes, they are.
Are they? Okay, that's
yes.
great. And so I'm assuming somewhere you're either going to or have reported in an extension publication or going to or something that lists these bulbs and what types they are. And
we already have quite a few publications that have existed from, you know, colleagues and researchers from past time. Not this particular research, of course. It's very early for
sure,
us. But
sure.
as soon as we have some data that is worth, publishing, we'll be sure to be available to make it available.
Well, I think we talked about this last week, and anytime I have someone from Extension on, but there is such an incredible resource through the University of Georgia Cooperative Extension online, and there's just not much you can't find. We were talking entomology last week. We're talking floriculture this week. I mean, you can find pretty much anything you want, or talk to your county agent as well. I mean, we've got county agents in every county, and great knowledge, great amount of knowledge, great brain power working for the people of Georgia, and I think that's great. And you're obviously one of those who likes color, which is one of the reasons I really like you. But also, you don't just do research, you teach. And so not every faculty member on the Griffin campus teaches, because research is so strongly important to us, but you do, and you offer at least one class that, like, blows the cap off enrollment every year. It's an online class. I want you to talk a little bit about that, because even the name's cool.
Right. thank you for that. I became really interested in teaching online about 5 years ago. So, again, University of Florida, Georgia, excuse me.
party foul.
Has this really great resource, Center for Online Learning. And so through a fellowship program, I was able to work with them on the main campus and develop this course. So it is Herbs, Spices, and Medicinal Plants.
That is the coolest name for a class I've ever heard in my life.
Now, I do have to say, I didn't come up with a class. This class was already being taught on the main campus by a colleague of mine, Dr. Jim Affelter.
Okay.
So that course really is very popular, and it's taught in the fall. And I came in, and I just added a section for online.
Okay.
And so my course is, like as you said, quite popular, and it's a 3,000 level, so it's it satisfies the science requirement
sure.
for many of the majors. So over the years, I've had a tremendous variety of different students. So
been
fascinating to see each different perspective that comes from the background and the area of study that, you know, an individual student brings. And it's fascinating that the subject meshes so well with each person. So everybody brings in something from their own experience. And it's quite rewarding to see how it brings the spark of interest in each student.
Oh, sure. It's great. And just as an estimate, each fall, how many students do you have in the class?
It's a summer class.
Oh, summer class.
So it's taught in the summer, and it's only over 1 month.
Okay.
And so it's in summer, two semester in July. It's open to only students in the University of Georgia.
Okay.
We've had as many as 187 students in one year. Now it's about 150.
Which
like
is incredible.
Steady. Oh, yeah. It's a lot of work.
Oh, yeah. I know you have busy all your months, but that's a busy month.
Yes, it is a very busy month.
That's incredible. I mean, that's another thing I like to for people to understand about faculty on the Griffin campus. You are multitaskers in every aspect of the word, and certainly with the busy schedule, extension wise, research wise, and teaching wise, you stay pretty busy. That's why maybe it's been 10 years since you've been on the radio show. We're going to remedy that. It's going to be less than 10 years the next time, but certainly
looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's a great thing. We talked a little bit about how you chose your career path, but let's kind of segue to pollinators now. We talk about pollinators a lot in here because I really want to keep stressing the fact to everyone in Georgia and everyone listening. We have people listening around the world, not just in Georgia, but how incredibly important pollinators are and how going out and spraying your yard when you don't know what you're doing is not a good thing to do when you're killing all the bees around everything. So let's talk pollinators. And one thing I want to start this off with is last fall, there's something, you started some new plots in the garden, and we had some visitors, some butterfly visitors that we don't always have, and we also had some on the main campus. I'm crediting you with attracting them in because we're not on the flight path. In Texas, we were, and we had these visitors all the time. But talk about those visitors a little bit because it was incredible.
Yes, we were very fortunate to see a large number of monarch butterflies, and they came both to the main campus, you know, in the main area.
Sure.
With the turf building. We had a nice planter, large planter.
Absolutely.
With
it was incredible.
Quite a few of the food resources, which are milkweeds. And then, as you mentioned, across 1941 in the garden, we had my wildflower plots, and there I grew five species of milkweeds.
Okay.
And so we saw quite a few of the monarchs there as well. So the milkweeds provide food for the larvae of the monarch butterfly. So a monarch butterfly is an exceptionally interesting, I mean, again, it's a great, great animal, and it has a life story that someone has to spend time looking at.
Sure.
Because it's remarkable. But these butterflies go on a migratory path. So they, they overwinter in Mexico, and they fly over to in the summer in other places all over the country, and we are on the one of them, just kind of like a little bit of the path, but we hadn't seen so many because, again, we didn't have milkweeds.
Sure.
And it was a great year for monarchs last year in
okay.
general, so I don't know if we'll claim that much of the credit, if you have milkweeds, chances are you're going to see some monarchs. And most of the times, people notice the adult monarchs, butterflies. They're very large and very prominent, orange and black. And we started seeing them, pretty consistently from, about July through all the way into October.
Okay.
And as I mentioned, we saw quite a few monarchs. And while we started seeing the adults, we started counting the larvae, which are the little caterpillars. Now, the caterpillars are like eating machines.
Sure.
They will, defoliate an Asclepias, one milkweed plant, in a matter of hours.
Right.
I mean, you can just look at them and they munch and crunch. And they go from a small, tiny little, one eighth of an inch all the way up to about 2 inches in size in a pretty short period.
Sure.
And so that growth has to be fueled by food, and the food comes from milkweeds. So we planted many milkweeds, and again, in my research plots, that was part of looking at floral resources for arthropods in
okay.
general, and then pollinators in particular. Why is it important? I think that looking at preserving arthropods in general, so insects and related animals, is part of the larger preservation of biodiversity in everything that is around us. We have to recognize how important it is to preserve that biodiversity so we can continue enjoying not only the plants that we have around the wild species, but also the horticulture species, because, about 80% of the crops that are of high nutritional value are pollinated
exactly.
by insects. So we have to have those insects, and those are the pollinators. That's something that touches us, very, very quickly. But if you're looking at the grand scheme of things, the wild species that exist outside, they are the ones that are going to be requiring pollination by insects in order to set seed and then make more of themselves. And that goes for wildflowers, it goes for shrubs, it goes for trees. So it's very important. And then we also recognize that insects will feed various other higher what we call trophic levels of the ecological web. So they will be feeding snakes and birds and frogs and salamanders and, you know, other insects. Sure. And so forth. So one thing affects the other, and then the, you know, what's on the top is going to be feeding, like, for example, a snake is going to be feed a predator bird. And so it really does, it's like if you provide that food web that climbs higher and higher, it reaches us on the top.
Absolutely.
So one can quickly very see the importance of that biodiversity.
Absolutely. And that's so well explained, and thank you for doing that, because I think a lot of times people, and even the critters underground, I mean, we think when we talk about pollinators all the time, we rarely talk about all the biodiversity underneath the soil.
But, absolutely.
And then I think where I love what y'all are doing is we've got to continue to educate homeowners, and specifically, I love that the Center for Urban Ag is on our campus, because we set in such a perfect position to be urban and rural stuff in Griffin. But the Center for Urban Ag has so many great programs, but we've got the majority of Georgians living right up north of us in a big giant thing that funnels all the traffic into one place, which I still don't understand that. But anyway, we got them all living up there, and they're all wanting to have beautiful lawns and beautiful landscapes and all that. But they also all go to Lowe's or Home Depot and buy whatever they want to put on it. And I think that if nothing else, if we could continue to educate that, you know, having those wasps or those bees or those whatever, butterflies, or don't just kill the ground out, don't use Roundup on everything. If we continue to do that, there's such a critical, I don't know, a thin wire that we walk between, you know, loss of insects or arthropods and loss of us.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I have really started working on educating the public and the industry is to tolerate the wild aspect of a lawn and a garden. We don't have to eliminate every weed that pops up. We don't have to cover every single patch that of soil. For example, 70% of the native bees nest underground, so they do need to have access to bare patches of soil. And for years, we would talk about, you know, cover every inch,
sure,
of the landscape, so that, you know, I mean, there's a good reason for it. You know, mulching is very important. You know, we preserve the soil, no erosion, you know, runoff, stormwater, and all that. But it's just understanding the complexity of the system is part of us becoming more involved in being stewards of the environment in the best possible way. So I've been talking to people about habitat. So the habitat, it's not just floral resources, not just planting some nectar sources and pollen sources, but thinking about, okay, some water, some flat stones for the butterflies to sun, for the insects to, you know, stand around a little bit before the temperature start warming up so that they can start flying around, and then layers of vegetation so that they can find these places to nest, and you know, leave some bits of old logs around and parts of the wood and the litter on the ground. So all of these things are not exactly, you know, all that neat and great looking in the landscape, but they do add up to a significant habitat amelioration and making it so that those arthropods and all the critters that come with them stay around and really, you know, are beautiful to enjoy.
Absolutely. And that's why I love what you do so much, because there are a lot of people that would listen to what you just said and said, oh, no, I have to have my yard pristine and blocked and everything, and I don't want this. I want everything to look uniform. You know, my yard, when I moved here, the tornado of 2011 had cleared the property I lived on of trees and topsoil and part of the house and everything else. I didn't move here until 15. But so I had a blank slate to do. And so my yard, I talked to the turf guys first, and it was going to cost a fortune to turf it. And I'm like, you know what? I'm pretty stubborn. I'm a native grass person. So I'm just going to work on it. So it took 3 years. Now, do I have southern crab in my yard? Absolutely. I don't know how many species of grass I've got in my yard, but I've got a really good coverage. But what I notice is, and I don't mow it down to golf course length every time. And what I notice is there's as many things in the levels of grass as there is on the flowers and around. But I'm willing to tolerate that. Now, friends of mine that come visit, they're slapping around at things, which is how we all get stung, is when we slap around at
things. Absolutely.
If we would just leave them alone, they'd be fine. But people, friends of mine, they come and say, why haven't you sprayed for that? Why haven't you sprayed for that? Oh, my yard was developed to bring them in.
That's
and it's
right.
Not uniform, and it's not, you know, pristine looking, but that's kind of what I'm shooting for.
I agree with you 100%.
Well, I tell you what, let's take our bottom of the hour break. We'll come back, talk more with Bodhi Panisi and all things pollinator, floriculture. I don't know what all we'll talk about. We'll talk about more when we come back.
You're listening to the University of Georgia Griffin Campus News on AM 1450 WKEU in Griffin, Georgia. Also heard on 102.3 FM and 88.9 FM The Rock, Georgia Public Radio at its finest. We're streaming live on the World Wide Web at WKEUradio.com, and you can take us with us wherever you go thanks to the free WKEU app for all smartphone and tablet devices. This morning's program continues after this.
Frank and Carolyn Harris of Round Oak Resources Tree Farm and Murray & Company Realty, proud supporters of the University of Georgia Griffin Campus, and proud to bring you this week's edition of the University of Georgia Griffin Campus News. As the UGA Griffin Campus grows with the great educational opportunities for our children, Round Oak Resources Tree Farm is growing our future with trees to support and assist our environment. Frank and Carolyn Harris of Round Oak Resources Tree Farm and Murray & Company Realtors are proud supporters of the UGA Griffin Campus and area youth activities in Griffin and Spalding County.
We have our own ray of sunshine in studio today for the first full day of spring. Let's continue this morning's University of Georgia Griffin Campus News with our host. He is the Campus Director and Assistant Provost, Dr. Lou Honeycutt.
Thank you, Tony, and thank you. I know you were talking to me about the ray of sunshine, so thank you so much for that.
Well, yeah.
Oh, wait, I can see the way you're looking. You must have met Bodie Panisi. I am here today with Dr. Bodie Panisi, who's a professor in the College of Agriculture and Environmental Sciences Horticulture Department on the UGA Griffin campus. Been here for 17, I guess, years, which is incredible. And one of the things Tony asked during the break, and I think it's a great question, is coming from Bulgaria, coming from an international scene to the United States a long time ago, but what's been kind of the – what was the hardest adjustment, or what was the most – thing? People ask me all the time, you go to Georgia, what's so different there? I'm like, well, nothing. I just came from Texas. It's not, but from Bulgaria to Florida, now Georgia, what's been the hardest thing to adjust to, maybe, or the most challenging?
The first 5 years, it really, the most challenging thing I'll have to say was the food.
Okay.
I grew up on a totally different diet, and I was just not used to the American foods that were available to me at the time. I would say slowly and surely I've adjusted. So I've learned to really enjoy Southern cooking.
Okay.
And I cook Southern myself. I actually, last night I did fried chicken. So
awesome.
That's pretty Southern.
That's pretty Southern.
I haven't got into the pies making, but I do like them.
Okay.
That's probably, I would say, the only thing that I found challenging, and that was really early on.
And then when you go back to Bulgaria, because I know you sent us pictures last year on the Black Sea, right?
Right.
I was going to say, I want to get my geography right, but incredible photos you sent back. But when you go back, do you have a hard time adjusting to food back home, or is it just like, oops, I'm just
no,
back
it's
home?
Like stepping back very quickly. Okay. And enjoying. Nowadays, you know, going back to what you mentioned about Atlanta, that's one thing I enjoy about a big city like this. You have all these international people in there.
Gosh,
I mean,
yeah.
It's like you can find food, you know, like my grandma used to say, you can find milk from a chicken. I mean, it's like, you can find anything.
Sure.
And there's stores, there are restaurants, you know, you have DeKalb's Farmers Market, for example, Buford High Market. So plenty of places you can go and find either fresh food or, you know, resources to cook and restaurants and enjoy different cuisines. And I'm pretty much a foodie myself. I'll eat anything and everything, you know. So as I told my husband years ago, I mean, I eat organ meat, so, you know, can't go that wrong from there.
Yeah, where else can you go from there?
This has been really interesting, and I've enjoyed learning how to cook in different cuisines, and the American cuisine has certainly had its own impact on me. So
sure.
I enjoy that.
Sure. Are you a spicy food lover, or?
I am. I am. For my family, I have to kind of back off a little bit, dial it back. My daughter, she's 13. She doesn't like spicy foods. And for her, spicy may be just a little bit of chili peppers.
Okay.
She'll tell right away. And she doesn't like citrus, for example, anything citrusy. So she can't put up with any lemon. And I've tested her. She has not been in the kitchen, and I will make like a hollandaise sauce. And uh-huh. it requires like 1 teaspoon
sure,
of lemon.
Sure, just a little bit.
And she would tell. She would tell you, this is spicy.
That's
and I'm
a
like,
discerning
spicy,
palate.
What do you mean? She was like, well, it's acidic. You put something in there, didn't you? You put lemon. I'm like, yeah, but it's cold for. So I had to really dial down for her.
Well, you know, I love spicy. I love hot if it has flavor. I don't like hot just for hot purposes or all, but because a lot of people, I'm the same way. Like when I go, I'm leaving from here to go to Athens today for meetings, and even in Athens, I try to eat at different places. And there's great Indian food. There's lots of different foods there, and I love the different international flair and flavors and spices, and I think it's great too. I wouldn't call myself a foodie because I eat a lot of popcorn and stuff out of the microwave, but because it's just easy and I'll get back outside. But I do enjoy the opportunities we have. I'm relatively new to Instagram and I actually enjoy it. So the ones that made me do this, they'll hear this and laugh. But what's cool about it is the ones on campus that are following me, I live vicariously through them. And David and Amy Mann and the Center for Food Safety are two great examples. They are on a trek to go. There's some kind of list that has IPAs and other really good homemade brews or beers, but also foods with them. And so when they travel, and then a lot of them are in Atlanta or around the state, but they post pictures. So I live through them, but it looks incredible, all the things they're doing. It
makes
gives
me hungry
ideas.
Just me too. Talking
gives
about
me
it.
Ideas of where I might want to go when I see their pictures. So I like Instagram for that. So, okay, so I'm hungry now too. So we got to get back to horticulture, let's do one more thing first, but everyone has to have some kind of hobby. So, and I know you don't have any spare time. People ask, what are you doing in your spare time? I'm like, my what? But in your spare time, when you do get a little bit of spare time, what kind of hobbies do you have or what do you like to do?
I would say quilting is...
I would have never picked you as a quilter. That's awesome.
I have done a fair amount of quilt, as my husband would say.
Okay.
Fair amount being a very gently put term. I've probably done about 300 quilts. And
holy cow!
People say, "What do you do? Sell them?" No, I don't sell them. It's like they're my children. I don't like to give away my children.
Wow, that's incredible.
But I would make quilts for people for like weddings and babies and things like that. I enjoy quilting. Like I said, I started learning about. Probably 15 years ago, and I taught myself, and from there on it's been a truly remarkable exploration of American history, and you learn so much about the land, the people, and the history behind every single block or quilt in particular, or a period of time. So it's when I retire, I would like to take a big trip through Kansas and the heartland and look at those quilts and the quilters.
Oh, absolutely.
There, so,
my grandmother, because I'm from Texas Panhandle, my grandmother was a big quilter, and crocheter and all those crafty things that I can't do, but that are so incredible to look at. But so 300 or so. So do you have like 200 of them in your house somewhere?
I do.
So you're kind of a quilt hoarder. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
I would have never, ever, ever guessed you as a quilter. That's incredible. I love that we asked that question.
I'll have to make you a quilt then.
You would. I was hoping that would come out of this, but no, that's incredible hobby to have. So so thank you for that. You don't have to give me a quilt, but if you want to, I'd take it. As kind of an additional to that, you've been on the Griffin campus for about 17 years, which is incredible. And I'm not paying you to give me the answer because it's just the open question. But what's your favorite part of the Griffin campus? There are so many favorite parts to me, and to me it is. And of course, I'm biased, but it is an incredible campus, and it just changes all the time. Just like with your project this year, the color popped. I mean, it's just, that's brand new, and it's going to be there forever. So, I mean, it's just, what's your favorite part, though?
I would say my favorite part are the people.
Okay.
Many of the people that I started with when I first came are still here,
sure.
And many have retired. New ones have come in, coming to work every day, and... appreciating the people around and their stories and keeping in touch with their families and what's happening in their personal lives and also, you know, the work relationship that we have. I work with many people on campus and I really enjoy that experience and that interaction. So it's usually when I want to be on the road is when I'm going to meet other people again outside. And in extension, as you can imagine, we meet many people.
Oh, gosh,
so I go around and I give talks. So I meet a lot of master gardeners and gardeners in general, and they are so much fun. I mean, they're just remarkable people. So it's my job is a lot of fun.
That's incredible. No, I love that answer. Usually it's people tell me locations or things, but to say the people, I agree with you. I mean, we are known for several things, and they're really great things. And one is everyone that comes from Athens or anywhere on our campus, if we're doing a golf cart tour or whatever, says everybody waves at everybody here. Everybody speaks here. And to me, that's so normal coming from where I come from that people just do that. But then I go to Athens and I'll be like on North Campus walking to eat somewhere and I speak to everyone and it literally scares some people because they're used to just looking at their phone while they walk and with their head down. And one of our students, Wendy Griffin, coined the phrase the Griffin wave to people she talks to now because she wasn't used to it either just in her trips to Athens and things, but she said it's just amazing. Everybody waves, and it's. But that's just how we are. It's been known for years as the family station because there was housing for families when it was it still is the experiment station, but for years. So I like that answer because I agree with you. And there is significant, just like you and Clint's interaction on the bowl project. There's significant interaction. There, no one just sits in their office and does their own thing and doesn't interact. So great answer. That was good. Anything big on the horizons in horticulture? What's the next big color or the next big something coming down the pike?
Ooh, that's a tough one. That's a tough question. I was just looking at some new plants that Greenhouse Grower put out. They're a company that has a magazine, and they also go around the country. They visit growers, large growers, small growers, and they put a lot of information, cutting edge technologies that are coming down the pipe from plants to growing, and pesticides and techniques and things like that. So I was just looking through their new plants, and that's usually what gardeners do. People
sure.
that love plants, they look at the newest, kind of like fashion, what is the
sure.
newest? And it's hard to resist because spring is always the time that everybody starts twitching, their fingers twitch, and we start looking at being outside and planting and growing and trimming and pruning and doing all these things. It's really difficult for me to put one thing out there. I think it's very exciting to be in horticulture. I think that there is great opportunities to look into all aspects of horticulture, from the ornamental side to the foodie side.
Sure.
And to public gardens and ornamental horticulture and interacting with the public and educating the public, working with people, volunteers. So all of that really encompasses horticulture, and I think that we're really poised to push out in a major way.
I think so too. And horticulture is such a large component of the Griffin campus. And in the Dundee Cafe, which by the way is going to open very soon, we hope to make an announcement really quickly. There's kind of what I call it the homage wall, but it's a patent wall, and it's to praise faculty for their patents that have come off the Griffin campus. And for those who don't know, when you research, you can do, there's several different types of things that can be patented as they come off the line or of the test. And I'm proud to say this is 1995. We had 94 of them. And when you look at that list, horticulture, which if you look at the staffing and all, is a smaller component of the campus. But when you look at the patent list, the vast majority of things on there are from the Department of Horticulture on the Griffin campus. And I think that speaks volumes about the broad base and the incredible statewide impact work that you're – and I'm not just bragging because you're here with me. I brag about this all the time. But I'll use Scott Neesmith as an example. We basically are the blueberry state because of research done on the Griffin campus by Scott Neesmith. I mean, that's incredible to me. I mean, he's got blueberries from the apple size all the way down to – he's got ornamental blueberries. He's got – and that's done on the Griffin campus. So I agree with you. Horticulture, to me, is poised to explode. We've got – and the foodie groups that are in Athens are one of the things that are going to make that happen, because now they're talking about, I want my yard to be edible. I want everything that I'm growing, which is again good for pollinators. We want them to do that, but then they want to be able to take it right from the yard into the table. And that's
right.
A good idea. And that the vendor in our cafe, by the way, the reason we're not open right now is she just had her first grandbaby, and she's been in California for that, which is great. It's hard to say, nope, don't go to California. But beautiful baby girl, and she's back in. She's on campus today, but we hope to be making a really important announcement about maybe some food showing up.
Oh, looking forward to it.
Pretty quickly. And she's farm to table as well, so we're happy that she works with local farmers and does all that. But so let's talk more about the bulb project. I mean, what when you it's going to go on forever, or I don't know, I say forever,
at least 3 years.
At least 3 years. Okay. So the cool thing to me is, and it, you spoke about it a little bit, but if it's successful, which our first year one, I'm going to say is, in my opinion, successful because of all the color that came up. So we'll see what happens in year two. But this seems to be very applicable to the industry, to me, to especially to the urban industry, which I think, you know, I think is the one we need to be directing a lot of our resources towards, because that's where a lot of the youth and people are. But so is that kind of the impetus for doing it? I mean, is to let's make an I like it because it's applied research, which I like that. You come out with an answer, take it to extension office, and then give it to the people that do it. But is that kind of why y'all decided to do this? And is Clint involved because of golf courses and things like that, or just specifically just turf in general?
It is turf in general.
Okay.
And so we're looking at all applications, you know, whenever there is turf, whenever there is some kind of grass cover, and we're putting bulbs, spring flowering bulbs in particular in this case here, and doing the double cropping and the transitional, you know, turf, if you will. And so there was research that was done by Ellen Bowski, also with Clint Waltz earlier, sure, on edible lawns.
Right, right.
So she had some materials that she grew that could be, you know, eaten, quite a few lettuces and I think some other things as well. So the difference there was, well, not only the plant that she worked with, they were putting it, the plants that were not grass, they were planting with a bulb planter. So
okay,
they would go in there and they'll punch a hole in the turf in the ground, and then they'll pop in the lettuce plant,
okay,
a seedling,
okay,
or whatever it was. In our case, we're actually using a machine that was developed by Dutch technologists.
Okay.
And it's specifically designed to plant mass quantities of bulbs under turf. So that machine came on campus, and we have videos and, you know, photos, so we can actually make it available for people to take a look at how
cool
that is. That machine is going to be used most likely by landscapers, golf course as well. So it's not going to be applicable to consumers directly. But what Ellen Bowski's research did and Clint's research, they talked about the same concept, and that is to punch a hole and put, you know, a bulb or a lettuce or whatever you're putting in the turf. And so in our case, the concept is pretty much the same. It's different. The application is slightly different. It's commercial, large-scale, mass planting,
okay,
versus individual planted.
Sure.
The concept is the same.
Sure. I've been, and I'm sure you have too, I've been fortunate to be in the Netherlands and to see the tulip production and the polder and everything Dutch, which is great. They grow a lot of tulips.
They sure do.
So I'm sure they it's no wonder they came up with the technology to do this. But incredible country. Anybody ever gets to go, they need to go tour and enjoy the international flair. If you had to name your favorite plant, favorite color, there's got to be one plant. Like, I'm a native grasses person, which isn't, there's flowers on them, they're just not real big. But if you were to name your favorite plant, this is like Barbara Walters used to say, if you were a tree, what kind of tree would you be? If you were a plant, Bodie, what kind of plant would you want to be?
That's a tough one for
it
me.
Is tough.
It is. I have to think about what I would enjoy the most. And again, it goes back to the pollinators and seeing how many come to this one particular plant. And I would say that is probably a aster, a kind of native aster. And
okay,
there are quite a few different species out there. So anything that has multiple blooms that bursts into flower in September going into October. I mean, you have New England asters, which are pink and purple, a little bit larger blooms. blooms to more of the white little tiny ones, frost asters, calico asters, heath asters. Those are, so let's call it an aster.
Okay. It's an aster there, yeah.
It's a great pollinator attractive plant, good for floral resources because you have lots of blooms and late in the season when there are not that many other plants. So they're very important to provide that late season floral resources. They look great and they seem to not have any problems in the landscape. We see quite a few of them out there. Absolutely, that would be one.
Okay, I love it. That's a good. So now we know what kind of plant it would be if you could be a plant one of the asters. Let's take our next break. We'll come back, do some finish up, some final thought kind of things, and talk more with Dr. Bodhi Panisi.
Frank and Carolyn Harris of Round Oak Resources Tree Farm and Murray & Company Realty. Proud supporters of the University of Georgia Griffin Campus and proud to bring you this week's edition of the University of Georgia Griffin Campus News. As the UGA Griffin Campus grows with the great educational opportunities for our children, Round Oak Resources Tree Farm is growing our future with trees to support and assist our environment. Frank and Carolyn Harris of Round Oak Resources Tree Farm and Murray & Company Realtors are proud supporters of the UGA Griffin Campus and area youth activities in Griffin and Spalding County.
In announcements from the University of Georgia Griffin Campus, the Dundee Cafe at the historical UGA Mule Barn is happy to announce From the Farm as the new vendor. Culinary artist Marcy Bradbury will be heading up the cafe in the newly renovated facility, and the doors will be open to the public very soon. The Dundee Cafe sits in the heart of the Griffin Campus and will be a welcoming place to meet and eat for the entire community. This renovation of the 100-year-old Mule Barn was made possible through a gift from the Dundee Community Association. Dundee Mill operated in Griffin for over a century in the area which was across from the experiment station and is now the University of Georgia Griffin campus. Announcements for the grand opening are coming soon. A storm damaged tree cleanup training course will be offered for the private sector only Tuesday, March 26th from 9 a.m. until 3:30 p.m. at the UGA Research and Education Garden located at 129 West Ellis Road. Participants must be trained in basic chainsaw safety, use, and maintenance. Certification will be provided upon completion of the course. The cost of the class is $20 and includes lunch. For more information on this and public sector training, call Ellen Bowski at the UGA Center for Urban Agriculture at 770-233-5558. A special financial planning symposium advising and mentoring minority students for success is scheduled for April 5th from 8 a.m. until 1 p.m. in Stuckey Auditorium on the UGA Griffin campus. Faculty, staff, and leaders in the financial planning industry will come together to exchange ideas, to network, and to discuss ways to promote overall diversity in the financial planning field through the UGA Griffin campus of the College of Family and Consumer Science. For more information, you can call 770-412-4400 or visit online at www.griffin.uga.edu. And a reminder that the deadline for summer undergraduate classes is slated for May the 1st. Call the UGA Griffin Campus Academic Affairs Office for more information. That number 770-412-4400. Down. Let's dot the I's and cross the T's on the program with our host. Here is Dr. Boo Honeycutt.
Thank you, Tony, and as always, thanks for the Darth Vader music. I love it. That's great. It kind of sets my mood for the rest of the day. We have been having a great time, as always, with Dr. Bodhi Panisi, professor in the Horticulture Department in the College of Ag and on the Griffin campus for about 17 years, which is great. One of the last things we wanted to talk about is we wanted to get other people psyched about horticulture and how they can become, how they can get into horticulture and kind of what career paths are there. And let's just talk how, if a student's out there saying, hey, I kind of like flowers, I might want to do that. What advice do you have for them?
I would say come on. We'll find a way to for you to get into horticulture and find you the best fit, depending on what your interests are. You could be interested in landscape, and we have in our undergraduates, we have landscape contracting and management. So people that are interested in working for anything from running their own landscape firm to being a part of large corporate landscape firms, maintenance of residential, commercial, corporate, municipal, and institutional landscapes. And again, I would be more than happy to work with them
on
that.
Sure.
And some of my colleagues on campus as well. We have community gardening for the foodies. So we call it the Ride a Foodie Wave, and you can have a certificate in local food system, and you learn about organizing, funding, design, planting, and maintaining community gardens. And those, again, can help with these efforts like food kitchens, neighboring communities, CSAs, and that sort of thing. Then we also have greenhouse and nursery management. These are for the specialties for folks interested in managing plants, materials, people, and of course money, while producing anything from foliage plants for interior scapes, vegetable transplants, cut flowers, potted plants, and landscape ornamentals. That's the production aspect of horticulture, and it's on the ornamental side. We also have public garden management for folks interested in managing botanical gardens, arboreta, and parks. We also have organic gardening, and that comes with a certificate in organic agriculture. So emphasis is on hands-on and learning about what makes an organic garden and how to produce food organically. So it's a challenge in the Southeast to manage with all the bugs and diseases that we have. And so that's a really great area to go into. We also have horticultural sales for people that are interested in more of a marketing and sales area. So you can look into retail and wholesale sales of fruits, vegetables, cut flowers, potted plants, ornamental plants, horticultural equipment, as well as pesticides and fertilizers. And then the last one we have is for people that are interested in continuing with a little bit of a graduate degree and perhaps even becoming a professor at a land-grant university or another place, or working in the industry in the R&D area, and those would be horticultural research. So we have all these, and as I said, there is a flavor for everyone.
Absolutely, lots of opportunities. And mentioning grad students, you may have a connection to Callaway Gardens now. You probably always had it, but you got a little better one now. Let's talk about that particular connection, because that's a great story.
Bethany Harris is the person you're referring to, and Bethany is had a great honor and pleasure to work with her for years and years and years. Since the beginning of her career,
sure.
She was a high schooler here.
As a young scholar.
She grew up in Griffin.
She came
to campus, and she really wanted to gain some hands-on experience and started working. So at the time, she didn't really know she wanted to do what she wanted to do, which areas. And she ended up working for me as a high schooler, then, like you said, young scholar. So she gained a little more experience and confidence, and then she went into the undergraduate field. So she got her bachelor's on our campus,
right.
And that was in the environmental resource major.
Right.
And then she went on to get a master's and work in the area of entomology. And she was the one that really started me on pollinators.
Okay, sure.
I was on her master's committee, and we worked with her major professor, Chris Brayman, who's a great collaborator of mine, and I really enjoyed over the years working with her. So Bethany finished her master's, and then I was very fortunate to be able to recruit her to work on her PhD with me. And so she graduated in December.
Absolutely.
And she went out to become the Assistant Director of Education at Callaway Gardens. And she oversees and manages the butterfly exhibits and also the horticultural field. So she's... she's well on her path to achieving all the goals that she had, and she was a pleasure to work with. Triple dog.
Absolutely. Triple dog, I'm telling you. And you had such you are such a great as was Chris, and many people were such great mentors to her. But Bethany's story is so great, and she's just you can't know Bethany and not just love her. She's just incredible. But the great thing about it, and I've met her folks, and she's been a part of the campus the whole time I've been here, and certainly before me. But her mom tells a story that, she was in 4-H and then she did Young Scholars. But when she was in 4-H, she was extremely shy. and very reserved and very no, if I'd have met her as a 4-H'er, I would have never expected her to be assistant director of educational programs with a PhD. But it really goes to show how you get with, and I'm gonna brag on you, but the Griffin campus as a whole, if we get can hook in students and young scholars, get them there, they're going to blossom. And horticulture blossomed. That's a good segue. But they're going to – they can meet their incredible potential, and we're going to help them get there with the people like you and Chris Brayman and Carol Rohrbacher and everybody that interacted with Bethany during her time there. But she is a great – I always call her the poster child for why we're successful, is because she went from a high school 4-H'er who literally her mom says wouldn't talk to anybody to now a PhD who's doing educational programs at Callaway Gardens.
And an outreach and that perfect interaction between, you know, the crossroad between science and outreach.
It's incredible.
It's a great place to be.
I cannot wait to go see her. And I was at Callaway meetings recently, didn't get to even go over and say hi, but I'm going to go back. I sure.
I'm planning to.
Yeah. Well, Bodie,
I'm hoping for some tickets for her.
Absolutely. We ought to get something, right? Thank you so much for joining us today. We have been visiting with Dr. Bodie Panisi, professor at the University of Georgia College of Agriculture and Environmental Sciences Horticulture Department, located on the Griffin campus. Keep up the great and colorful work, because I get to benefit from it by walking by it every day. So we appreciate everything you do. And Tony, I guess that'll do it for us today. We'll see y'all next week.